This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. We aim to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. This episode, we look at a volunteer pilot organization that flies conservation groups, community groups, the media, other decision makers on environmental monitoring and survey flights. In the news this episode, the best-selling piston aircraft in 2023, student pilot statistics, which look pretty good, around the world in a Learjet, Las Vegas eyes an additional airport, people skipping security at airports, failure to disclose flight deck features, and Spirit Airlines deferral of Airbus orders. All that and more coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 794 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and with me is first Max Trescott. He's host of Aviation News Talk Podcast. He's a national CFI of the year. And if you are interested in learning to fly or purchase a Cirrus aircraft, well, I think Mr. Trescott is the guy you should seek out.
Hey, hello, everyone. Great to be here. Looks like we're going to have a fun show here tonight.
I think so. And it's always fun when we have Rob Mark with us. He's a bizjet pilot, a journalist, publisher of jetwine.com.
Hey, good evening from beautiful Chicago, where the sun has returned after. I mean, I think that's what many people were concerned about during the eclipse was it got dark. And what if it doesn't get light again? But it did. So I guess we're all okay.
Terrific. Also with us is David Vanderhoof. He's our aviation historian from the American Helicopter Museum.
And folks, you're all in trouble because I get to talk this episode because my boycott doesn't apply.
Okay. All right. If you've listened to the last few episodes, you know what that's all about. Our main man, Micah, is, we're pretty sure, off this week. He's been out chasing the eclipse, and we don't think he's got a location where he can join us. Meantime, we have a couple of guests, two guests this episode from South Wings. Now, South Wings is a volunteer pilot organization. They fly conservation groups and community groups, the media, decision makers on environmental monitoring and survey flights, as well as things like flights of persuasion and media flights. So joining us first, Chelsea Easter. She's South Wing's Director of Operations and Volunteer Pilot Engagement. Chelsea actually started in the mental health and education fields, but then she was introduced to South Wings, and so for the past 4 years, she's been recruiting, onboarding, and working closely with their volunteer pilots. So, Chelsea, welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast.
Hi there. Thanks so much for having me.
Also with us from South Wings is Landon Thorne. Now, he's a volunteer pilot, one of the volunteer pilots, but he also serves on South Wings' board. Now, Landon's been flying since his teens. He has a long career in private equity and venture capital investing, and he served as an officer in the United States Marine Corps Reserve. During his military career, he served in Vietnam, Africa, Europe, and the Middle East. And in Vietnam, he flew 163 missions as a backseater in a Cessna OV-1 Bird Dog. And I guess, Landon, you decided that you just really had to have one of these eventually, and you made it happen, didn't you?
I did. I fell in love with the airplane, even though the first ones I spent a lot of time in often got holes in them and pieces fell off. But it was a great airplane, and I just always promised myself I'd buy one. So I did. And it's in VMO6 Marine Corps dress, so it's authentic, so to speak.
Did you have to do a restoration of that?
A little bit, not much. The plane was in pretty good shape, and it had been started to be painted with the military colors and insignia and everything. I did a little fix-up to it, and then I changed the tail number because the tail number was just sort of a nondescript tail number, and I changed it to 68 Victor November for 68 Vietnam, and
Cool.
And that's its tail number. So
excellent, excellent. Well, it's great to have you on the Airplane Geeks podcast. And
thank you.
Coming up, Chelsea and Landon are going to help talk to us about South Wings and the work that they're doing. But first, we have some aviation news from the past week. Our first item, this comes from General Aviation News. And Max, this is kind of interesting. I mean, they're talking about the 10 best-selling piston airplanes in 2023. And if you had asked me to kind of guess, you know, what did I think that list would look like, I think I would have not been able to come up with anything very intelligent. But this is an interesting list.
You know, it is interesting. I think it is different from what people might guess it would be. And it's certainly different than what it was, say, 20 years ago. And so just to start off, 2023 had a lot of growth. Piston deliveries were up almost 12% last year, 1,600 airplanes delivered. By the way, that's a far cry from the peak, which was around 1979, which was around 17,000 airplanes delivered. So we are at about 10% of the peak that occurred. Now, there were many factors, I think, that caused that to be a bit of a bubble. So it was probably, you know, an unnatural, you know, high water point anyway. But let's get to the list here. So the number one is the Cirrus SR-22T, which is the top of their piston line, 355 sold, continues to be a popular aircraft. Way behind that, about half those, is the Cessna Skyhawk with 180 sold. Now, for many years, that aircraft was probably the most popular, but it's been a while since it's been at the top of the list. Piper, with their 100i model, sold 145. And now here's a surprise. Get back to number four, and it's the Cirrus SR-22, 142 sold. Now, I think I would have probably combined these two numbers, in which case you'd be looking at over 500 aircraft for that model. But they do break them out as separate ones. Then we get down to the Diamond DA-40, 119. Wonderful airplane. I've flown lots of those. And then, guess what? Who's coming back here again? It's Cirrus SR-20, 115 sold. So I found it just fascinating that three of the top six airplanes in terms of numbers sold were Cirrus aircraft. And I think most people would not have expected that. Just to finish out the list, Diamond DA-62, 66 sold, which, by the way, means they're selling more of those than the DA-42. Technam Mentor 60, Technam P210 58, and finally the Pipistrel Alpha, which would now be owned by Textron. So it's kind of a Cessna cousin, if you will. 53 of those sold. So that's what the list looks like right now. What do you think?
It's pretty amazing that Cirrus kind of dominates in total as a manufacturer across this list. I think this comes from Gamma, their 2023 General Aviation Aircraft Shipment Report. They put that out each year. We'll put a link in the show notes to the actual report. It's a PDF that you can look at yourself. There were some comments in the General Aviation News article on this topic, and I think one person was commenting that, and I think referring to the fact that Cirrus was such a dominant manufacturer that maybe the others need to kind of reevaluate maybe the how modern their airplanes are if they wish to compete with Cirrus.
Well, but keep in mind the Skyhawk and the Piper 100i are basically training airplanes, and I don't know this for a complete honest fact, but I'm pretty sure that both of those airplanes sold most of their aircraft to fleet buyers, flight schools, and that sort of thing. And but there are some Cirruses, or Max, is it Cirri? Cirruses?
Yes, that is correct.
Quite under, yeah, okay.
Whatever you want to call it is correct.
But and of course, you know, the T, in case people were not aware, was the SR-22 turbo, outsold the standard normally aspirated airplane. But Max, wasn't I'm almost certain I remember seeing a Cirrus that was going to be maybe it was a 20 or I believe it was a 20 model, that was going to be primarily for the flight training industry. Did that not go anywhere, I guess?
Oh, that's a good point. Last year, I think around April, they certified a model which was kind of below the SR-20. And when Cirrus was questioned about that, they said that it was primarily done for the Chinese market. So I was kind of surprised. I thought they would bring that out as a light sport aircraft in the U.S. Maybe they will, and maybe they just weren't being upfront about that. And the way that came to light was it showed up in the list of FAA certified aircraft database. Someone flagged me about that early on, and I looked at it and, you know, didn't say anything about it. And a month later, it kind of came out in the press. So, yeah, it was kind of interesting to see that. But so far, much ado about nothing, but we'll see. Hmm.
Lennon, have you flown any of the aircraft on this list, or what other airplanes have you flown?
Mostly, for me, mostly Pipers and Bonanzas. I mean, I owned a couple of Bonanzas for a long time. I flew them pretty much. V-tail and straight-tail Bonanzas. So, you know, I kind of loved the V-tail. It was a very stable, wonderful platform. And, you know, with Bonanzas, if you flew them by the numbers, they were just like on a wire. You know, they were just, they're a great airplane. I hate to tell you, I soloed in a J3 with light signals, you know, no radio, and, you know, Pipers, short-wing Pipers. If you shut the power off, they just go down like a rock and fine airplane. So I flew a bunch of Pipers, had a Piper Clipper for a long time in my youth. And I've had some rides in Cirruses. I mean, I like Cirrus. I can see why Cirrus is because for general aviation, it's fabulous. I mean, it's got all the gadgets and it looks terrific.
Yeah, comfortable. Yeah, nice aircraft.
I guess the one comment I'd add to that is if I think back to the 80s and 90s watching general aviation, yes, there was change. Things did move in the industry, but it felt like it was on a glacial timescale. I mean, it just did not move much at all. Cirrus introduced the SR-22 in, I believe, I'm sorry, they introduced the 20 first in 1999. And wow, it was just so different from everything else. A lot of people poo-pooed it. A friend of mine who was at the Cessna dealer dinner said that there was kind of a round of boos back in the early 2000s when it got mentioned. And I think they kind of thought, oh, this is an upstart. They'll never, you know, they will never become this big. But I think it has to do with their approach to constant innovation. And we see that in a lot of high-tech companies. If you're out there every year making new changes and new updates, and they did. I remember I went back to the factory one year, and they'd made something like 120 changes from the prior model year. And it wasn't a model year change. It was just going back and, you know, fine-tuning things. And that's just a great strategy for growing a company.
Yeah, very successful. All right. We have another item from General Aviation News. More pilots in 2023. More pilots is always good. Right, Max?
Yeah, this actually is pulled from information that Jason Blair, who's a DPE in Michigan, posted. And Ben Sclair at General Aviation News picked up on it. And he said that there was a big jump in student pilots. So in 2023, there was a 24% increase in student pilots, which is huge. So they went from about 56,000 student pilot certificates issued in 2022 to over 69,000 issued in 2023. And if you think back, that was kind of getting toward the end of the pandemic. The airlines were just starting to hire again. A lot of people suddenly thought, hey, this looks like a very attractive career to get into. And we've seen kind of a good long-term trend. Jason put together a chart showing what's happened with a number of different certificates from 2010 through 2023. And it's been fairly steady growth up and to the right. There was a little dip in 2021, but that's because, again, the pandemic, not as much flight training. But if you look at, for example, private certificates in that 13-year period, they've gone from 15,000 per year to over 30,000 per year. So that is a huge, huge percentage increase. And we've also seen increases in instrument ratings and commercial pilot ratings. And what's going to be interesting, I think, to see is what happens in the next year or two, because we're now starting to see a slowdown in hiring by the major airlines. And I have a feeling that may cause some people to kind of rethink their choices. We might not see as much of a jump in growth in the coming years, but certainly it's been a robust market, and a lot of people have jumped in.
It still represents an opportunity, I think, because when you look at the student pilot starts in the 60s, it's a great effort, but the student pilot or the private pilot certificates issued are still down in the 30s. So there's still a gap there between the number of people that begin training and those that actually finish.
Yeah, which has always been the case. There's no question. A student pilot certificate, you don't need to take 1 hour of flight training to get it. You can have 0 hours and apply for it. So it doesn't tell us about how much sustained training has occurred, whereas the private tells you, hey, somebody went all the way through the process. So yeah, there's a significant number of people that don't finish.
So this data comes from the U.S. Civil Airman Statistics page, which we'll have a link in the show notes for. It says it contains detailed airman statistics not published in other FAA reports. For this purpose anyway, what's the definition of an airman?
Boy, I think that covers just about anybody who has any type of pilot certificate. So that's going to include everything from balloonists to glider pilots to, I don't know if parachute riggers are considered airmen, but they might be. So it covers just about anything that would be issued as a pilot certificate by the FAA.
Hmm. Well, and for you data dinks out there, the active civil airman statistics are available currently in spreadsheet form. And actually, you can go back to 2018, at least currently. They have these spreadsheets, 2018 to 2023, which are really large and contain a ton of information. So if you'd like to dig into that stuff, that's something you might look at.
A data dink?
Yeah.
What the heck is a data dink?
That's a – if you are one
– I thought data geek was – oh, is that different than a data geek?
I thought nerd was the preferred term. I mean, that's my preferred badge.
Well, and see, now you're really going to confuse people. I mean, so where does a nerd, a geek, and a dink? What's the priority there? I mean, well,
they all walk into a bar? Is that what you're trying to say? A nerd? Yeah.
Well, just to be clear, a DINK is an acronym for dual income, no kids, and so I think that's a totally different subject.
I see.
All right, moving along from Aviation Week, Rob, there's a Learjet, the Learjet 36A, that's set off on an interesting flight.
Yeah, Molly had a good story in Aviation Week about a Model 36, which alone makes it a pretty old airplane. It departed Wichita on a around-the-world flight. And they think it's going to take set a new record for old jets going around the world. And, of course, it's going westbound, which means it's always headed into the wind. But they think it'll be around 60 hours or so for this aircraft to make it around the world and get back. And I think they contrasted that by looking at the guys that did this in
1924, 100 years ago this week.
I was going to say, I knew that the year stuck in the back of my brain somewhere, but you know what? It's so far in the back, I couldn't grab it. This is what happens when you get old. But it took 175 days for these Army pilots to go around the world. Of course, they didn't do it nonstop, in case anybody's wondering. And again, so it just to demonstrate how far aviation has come and how much life some of these older airplanes still have in them. And so they'll be looking for it to get back. In fact, it's probably, this was dated the 3rd, I believe, the story. So it's probably back by now, if not just about back. We'll have to check on that.
Yeah, and I think they're intending to use this flight also as a fundraiser. They're looking to restore this 1964 Learjet Model 23. It's owned by the Classic Learjet Foundation. And that particular airframe, as I understand it, was the first Learjet that was delivered to a customer. So that's certainly a worthy aircraft to try to restore.
Sure. And that was 60 years ago that first Lear was delivered. So we were all just kids. And, some of us were kids, but then there were some of us that some of us were not even around 60 years ago. I don't know who that would be exactly, looking at all the faces, but I'm sure they know who they are.
Speaking of Bill Lear, you know the other famous product that he invented, right?
Lear Star.
The tip of my tongue. It's back there with Rob's back of the brain.
Oh, I'll have to help you on this one. The 8-track tape.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah. Wow.
Which is about as different from business jets as you can get. And, of course, a little bit less successful than the Learjet was.
I did have an 8-track for a period.
Oh, yeah.
Chelsea, have you ever even seen an 8-track tape?
Don't worry. I've seen an 8-track tape.
Okay. All right. We would not be able to continue if you had not done that.
Otherwise.
It's okay.
Well, one thing we're getting ready to see is a new airport or an additional airport for Las Vegas.
Yeah, this really surprised me when I ran across this story. Came out from, 8 News Now, which would be a CBS affiliate in the Las Vegas area. And it says that the work has been going on for a while. They started thinking about this back in the 1990s. They started out with 16 candidate sites for an additional airport for Las Vegas. They're now down to 4 sites. And I guess it's been tough to kind of figure out where they'd have enough land and where to fit it in next to some of the other issues they have there, such as the Nellis Air Force Base and airspace associated with that. But it's not going to happen right away. Project completion is slated for 2037. But I think Micah had commented this would be the first new airport built, large commercial airport since Denver Stapleton was replaced. So, I mean, it's just interesting to me that they've got so much traffic that they feel that they need a whole other airport. I went and looked up and saw that if you look at the rankings here in the U.S., in 2022, they ranked number 7 by total passengers. So not at the top, but up there pretty high. And I think they said most recently they were running about 56 million passengers per year. So anyway, may get a little more confusing when you fly to Las Vegas in the future as to which airport you're going to. Speaking of confusing, I saw this story today. The Port of Oakland has proposed modifying the airport's name. Any idea what they'd like to rename the Port of Oakland OAK Airport to?
Wasn't it Southern San Francisco or something it was sort of like connecting it to San Francisco versus Oakland.
Yeah, exactly. The proposed name for the Oakland airport is to become the San Francisco Bay Oakland International Airport. Does that sound at all potentially confusing?
It does.
Apparently in this story, they said that, they thought it might help increase their business if they could confuse people and trick them into coming to the wrong airport. I have a feeling that's not going to happen. I suspect that San Francisco International is going to protest.
No doubt. Yeah.
Well, luckily, when people call in on the frequency inbound, they'll still be calling NorCal. So and not San. What was it? San Francisco? Southern San Francisco. What did you call it, Max?
There, see, exactly.
It's K-O-A-K.
Yeah, exactly. Totally confusing.
All right. Speaking of airports, Micah found this story. This was in the Washington Post. Hundreds of people bypassed parts of airport security last year. So the TSA, the Transportation Security Administration, says that since March 2023, there have been at least 300 instances of people bypassing parts of airport security. Now, they say these aren't full security breaches. These are cases where passengers maybe bypassed some of the checks, but they went through others or they didn't, and they were identified and stopped. But still, since March 2023, 200 people bypassed exit lanes that are often marked with no reentry signs. 80 people evaded the travel document checker. Although, you know, there's an interesting thing here. It says, well, that's a rate of about one person in 10 million. So, I mean, when you hear about this 300 instances of people bypassing security, I mean, that sounds really terrible. But when you think about it in terms of the rate and all the millions and millions of people that go through TSA security checks of various sorts, it kind of isn't that many. But I don't know. What do you think? Does it not matter that it's a teeny tiny percentage?
I think it depends upon the actual incident. And I mean, I can remember being one of those people years ago when I was at, I don't know, I was somewhere down in the South and I was not sure where I was going. And I'm looking around and I said, I go this way. And I went, this is the exit. And I must have taken half of a leg length out of the door. And I said, get that guy, you know, and three TSA guys came after me and said, you must go all the way back through again. And I went, but come on, guys, I'm a little lost. And, you know, they said, all the way through. what are you going to do? But anyway, I'm not saying they're all like that.
It's a small number, but it only takes one to really exacerbate that number, unfortunately. Given the scope, it's a small number, but all it takes is one of those people to have something happen and we have a dramatic change, and then all hell will break loose. Why was there 300? You know, so I mean, it's the same reason why retail stores are now removing online or self-checkouts, because they came across the realization that there was a lot of misappropriation of items, but a lot of it wasn't even intentional. You know, there was theft because of people doing it that way, but there's also a lot of other people who, you know, you thought you scanned both items and you only scanned one, you know, and that's... So it's a matter of the TSA still needs to shoot for 100%, but given realization, I think 300 out of that totals is pretty good.
Yeah, that was kind of my thought too. But you have to look at those cases and right, what was the potential? What was the motivation? The TSA says is that in most of these cases, people didn't have evil intent. Like with Rob's situation.
No, they were just like Rob.
Yeah, exactly. although there were a few that, some of them were people that just kind of lost their patience waiting in line and said, you know, the heck with it. I'm tired of waiting and, you know, went around or something. But
you know what I'm thankful for is all of the reports about people bringing firearms and such aboard airplanes, because that means the TSA are catching the important ones.
Yeah. All right, from yahoo.com. This is about, Rob, this is about Senator Tammy Duckworth. And, okay, we're going to use the B word here, but she feels that there's, a pattern of Boeing not disclosing 737 MAX flight deck features to pilots.
There has absolutely been a pattern among Boeing's other problems. We go back to the accidents that occurred with the MAX 7 or 8 years ago. But this all started when the fuselage panel blew out of that Alaska Airlines airplane in January. And, of course, it left a huge hole in the side of the airplane. and it depressurizes the cabin, and everything that's not tied down goes sailing out that hole. And what people came to realize was that the cockpit door flew open, and people were very surprised at that, including the pilots, because they were not aware that the system was set up like that. So that, I mean, and it does make sense from a physics standpoint that if you have one area of much higher pressure, you want to try to balance the pressure out when the system goes haywire, as it did when the piece fell off the airplane. Again, except the pilots didn't know it. And it was not the first time that the pilots were not aware of something that that was going on at a Boeing, because when those two MAX aircraft crashed in, was it 17 and 18 or was it 16 and 17? I can't quite remember. But the MCAS system that was designed by Boeing to try to make it fly like earlier models of the Boeing 737, so that no one would have to retrain their pilots, they kind of forgot to tell pilots about that too. So people were pretty upset with that. And it just is a little frustrating to people these days, because we don't trust Boeing the way that we used to. And again, people have said, well, why didn't they just, why didn't the pilots just read the manual about the 737 MAX and they'd have known this? And, well, actually, they wouldn't have, because it wasn't mentioned in there. And the other problem with the earlier mention of the MCAS is that Boeing never told anybody that the a failure of one angle of attack indicator was enough to get the MCAS to lose its mind and pitch the nose of the aircraft over. They kind of forgot to tell people that, too. And so, again, the folks at Tammy? She's the Senate's Aviation Safety Operations and Innovation Subcommittee Chairman. And she wants to get Mike Whitaker, the current FAA administrator, to come down on Boeing about this. And that there should be some penalty for Boeing leaving out these important pieces of information that the pilots may or may have benefited from if they had known about them. And, of course, there's also this last one that she's really upset about. And I must admit my bias. Tammy Duckworth lives 10 miles away from me here and flies out of a different airport. She has a Comanche, but she's an Illinois senator. But she was also upset that Boeing was trying to get a waiver from the FAA on another issue with the 737 MAX, that the engine nacelles can overheat if they're in non-icing conditions for longer than 2 minutes. And there's no way for the pilots to time this unless they happen to have a stopwatch or they hit the button on their phone or on the timer on the panel. And if they don't get it right, it can cause some serious deformation and possible pieces of the engine nacelle to leave the airplane, like the one did. That wasn't an engine overheat that caused the Southwest Airlines airplane engine nacelle the other day out of Denver to depart the airplane, and it whacked the flaps going out, and they had to return for landing. But so, you know, we're only reporting. We didn't make all this stuff up. It's a shame that that this is happening to Boeing, but they have a lot of a lot to answer for, I think.
Yes, I think they do. And on this issue, I think the NTSB concurs. Jennifer Homendy told reporters concerning this cockpit door opening when the depressurization of the cabin occurred. She said that nobody knew about it, so it was a complete surprise, and the flight crew needs to know, she said. And she added, knowing this could occur is pretty key to safety.
Well, and think about it. We were talking about safety a little earlier with, David talking about what goes on at TSA and all that. And if you were a bad guy and you knew that all you needed to do was get the cabin to depressurize and the cockpit door could fly open, you could have someone up there waiting for that and figure out some, let's say, non-lethal method of depressurizing the cabin. And when the cockpit door opens, they can run in. So that's another serious issue they need to work on.
Yeah, that exact thought occurred to me earlier today. It does sound like something that you could leverage if you were intent on doing something bad.
Boy, that never crossed my mind. How come you two are so evil? That's what I'm...
it's just a trait.
Because we don't get out enough.
All right. Hey, one last story. Spirit Airlines and Max T, they've been in a kind of a cash crunch situation lately, and they're going to take some action to try to reduce that a little bit.
Yep. So they've certainly been on the news a lot in the last year. And part of what is driving this is that apparently they have had excess capacity in a number of markets, and so they've had to discount fares to fill their airplanes. And so the result is that they're making fewer dollars per passenger, at least they were in the last quarter last year, than they have done previously, all of which results in a cash crunch. And so they reached a deal to delay deliveries of their new Airbuses that they had scheduled to deliver from 2025 through 2026. And they're actually pushing them out about 5 or 6 years. And so the upshot of that is that they have announced that they're going to be furloughing about 260 pilots starting on September 1st. And we can actually probably work backwards and figure out roughly how many that airplanes is. I think I mentioned last week that it takes about 8 to 12 pilots per airplane. So if we do real quick mental math, this looks like it's over 20 airplanes, maybe 22, something like that. They did announce, and this is kind of odd, that there would not be any furloughs of cabin crew. So something must have been a little out of balance there if they have enough cabin crew but too many pilots. So who knows, why that is the case. But this is going to impact Airbus a little bit, and so they're going to have to push out those deliveries for them. And by the way, as I was thinking about this just now, I kind of realized, we were talking about B for Boeing, A for Airbus. I think I figured out years ago how Airbus chose their name. They wanted to be ahead of Boeing in the phone book when people went to buy an airplane. So.
Let's not forget that the other issue of that's plaguing Spirit is that the potential merger with JetBlue came undone last month. And I believe the Spirit folks were saying, this is going to happen just at the right time that the merger is going to come to be, because we kind of need some cash to help take delivery of all these airplanes. And I'm sure that JetBlue was looking forward to being able to grab some of those airplanes. And now that that whole thing has fallen apart, Spirit is kind of stuck with the check, and I don't think they're feeling really good about that. But there's also, as the story mentioned, still some issues about that Pratt & Whitney engine issue that's going to be grounding many Airbus 320 in the 320 Neo system, and so that is also going to affect the poor guys at Spirit. So all in all, 2024 is not looking like a really solid year for Spirit Airlines.
Yeah, it says they're going to have up to 40 of their jets grounded by the end of this year. That is a lot. I'm not sure the size of their fleet, but that's got to be a significant percentage.
Again, we're speaking with Chelsea Easter and Landon Thorne from South Wings. Again, that's a nonprofit conservation organization, I guess you could say, founded in 1996, if I have that straight. It's a network of volunteer pilot advocates. Maybe, Chelsea, maybe you can tell us a little bit about what it is that South Wings attempts to do.
Yeah, sure. So that's right. South Wings started in 1996, and were kind of modeled on another conservation aviation group called Lighthawk. Our co-founder was a Lighthawk pilot for many years, doing some volunteer flying for Lighthawk out in the West in Colorado. And he brought the idea of conservation through aviation back to the Southeast when he moved back to Chattanooga, Tennessee. And with our other co-founder, Jay Mills, they developed the idea for South Wings. And so they envisioned it as an organization that will use pilots and planes to document landscape-level environmental impacts in the Southeast. And so, yeah, we craft flight experiences that provide passengers with the inspiration and evidence that they need to protect and restore our ecosystems and communities that are facing environmental threats.
So tell us a little bit about, or give us maybe some examples of, you know, some of the flights that have taken place, some of the issues that caused South Wings to, you know, to want to get involved in this and support an effort.
The first South Wings flights back in 96 were focused on forestry practices in the Cumberland Plateau. So the story goes, Hume was flying around one day and noticed some clear cutting that was going on in the mountains there, and learned that it was these wood pellet mills were chopping down the forest and converting the trees into wood pellets for fuel. And so he started flying these monthly survey flights in Tennessee to determine the sourcing areas of these wood chip mills. And many of the passengers who were on board these flights were staff members of environmental groups who were doing, you know, work that, you know, on the ground work to combat this issue. And so South Wings was able to provide that tool of flight to help them advance and, you know, expand the capacity of their work, because it's such a useful tool for these types of things. And so now we focus on all sorts of issues. We get, you know, exposing the negative effects of mountaintop removal coal mining and watershed protection, coal ash disposal, monitoring industrial farming operations. We get requests for all sorts of flights.
So are these kind of activities that you're taking a look at, flying over them, are they typically illegal operations per se, or may not necessarily be illegal but have a significant environmental impact?
Yeah, not always illegal practices that are going on. So we employ three flight models. And so one of them was monitoring and survey flights. So this would be, you know, providing that aerial coverage to areas that are often remote or inaccessible by ground. A lot of times gathering data that may be used for scientific or regulatory purposes. A lot of times, you know, ensuring that industries and companies and farms and everyone are complying with permits. And our flight partners are able to, you know, capture photographic evidence of someone violating a permit and then able to report that violation to the Department of Environmental Protection in that state. And so a really good example of those kind of flights are we fly water keepers very regularly. So through the Waterkeeper Alliance, you know, every major river in the U.S. has, or almost every major river has a waterkeeper who's kind of charged with protecting it. And a really, really great way for the waterkeeper to have a, you know what's going on with their river is to get up in the air and fly the river and look at the watershed. And they're able to identify sources of pollution and other threats to the river. And so those would be the monitoring flights. We also, one of the other models would be flights of persuasion. So these flights will give, you know, selected passengers, leaders from the community or decision makers. It gives them the opportunity to be inspired to, you know, lead positive change for natural resource awareness and protection. Because, you know, we all know that the flight experience and those powerful stories that you can bring back to Earth, they can really draw reactions and open eyes and lead to positive change. And then the third type of flight would be a media flight. So flying photographers, videographers, writers, you know, reporters to help them add that aerial view to their story. And many South Wings photos have ended up on stories in major media outlets and on the front cover of major newspapers and everything like that.
Landon, do the different volunteer pilots have different motivations for, you know, for doing this, for volunteering to help this organization, or is it sort of a everybody's got the same mindset?
Well, I certainly think there's a common, very central thread that people that fly for Southwings are interested in environmental causes or conservation. And I think also it's, you know, if when you're not flying so regularly as we maybe did when we were younger or had a mission or we were flying for business or whatever, this gives us sort of a reason to fly. And I think that's another sort of part of the motivation, although we've got a lot of young pilots. But I know in my particular case, it was, this is good. I mean, I can satisfy my interest in the environment, but also have a purpose for flying. So it was kind of a nice combination.
And are you flying your own plane?
I'm flying a bird dog.
Yeah.
So, I strap people in, explain them that those rockets, you know, don't flip that switch or we'll, people get kind of excited by flying in that airplane.
Yeah, yeah. How many pilots are there?
We've got 72, right?
75, oh, 75. At the moment. Yeah, 75 active volunteers right now and who rent or own their own aircraft. Southwings doesn't own any aircraft, so we do depend on our volunteers to provide the airplane. And yeah, a lot of times these pilots are looking for, you know, kind of a specific type of volunteer flying where it's a little more interesting than just transporting someone or something. You know, we're not going from point A to point B. These are, we're circling, we're doing, maneuvering to view specific points on the ground. It's low and slow, which is, I've been told, is the most fun type of flying. Getting to carry some really fascinating people in your planes as well, people who are passionate about the work that they're doing, and just sort of by osmosis, you get to learn something really interesting.
I can jump in on a little bit of that too, because sometimes these flights will go three and a half hours. I've got a 4.5 hour capacity in the bird dog, but you're flying at 1,000 feet or below because you're out over whatever you're over, you know, above ground level. You fly in the airplane every minute of the flight. There's no set and forget. You know, you're you're flying that airplane, and you know you've been flying after some of those flights.
Yeah, I imagine.
Boy, you definitely want to watch for obstacles when you're flying along at 1,000 feet.
You definitely keep it. I mean, you know, that's one of the beautiful things about topography and the other elements of for flight and thing. And you want to, and you also, we generally map out where we're going so that you can build some awareness, because usually, at least in most of the flights I take, the folks will send you maybe a Google Earth picture with some targets on it, so you can kind of really do a lot of prep to see where you're going to be flying.
How many hours a month would an average pilot fly?
It varies. It's all dependent on how often you want to fly. And it also varies throughout our entire service area, which is our service area is from the Chesapeake Bay region all the way down the East Coast and into the Gulf states, including coastal Texas. And there's various ranges of, you know, needs in that entire area. So we have a really high need in eastern North Carolina, a lot of flights in New Orleans, the Gulf Coast. And so, you know, in those areas, we may have a flight once, twice a week. Generally, we tell our pilots you can expect a flight request from us maybe 1 to 3 times per quarter, and depending on a few factors there. But if a pilot wants to, we have a pilot who flew 75 hours last year, volunteer hours last year, and that's, you know, one flight a week at least. And then some of our pilots fly, you know, once a year or once every 2 years. So it really just runs the gamut there.
I think also it could be situational too. So if there's an oil spill in the Gulf, the Gulf area pilots are going to be flying a lot. I remember after Hurricane Matthew came through our area, I was up in the air every day for a week or something, because every person that was worried about erosion or the loss of bird habitat and stuff like that, there were at least three or four flights that and then, as Chelsea says, there might be a time when things are slow and you just don't fly that much. But occasionally it can be situational. There could be some pressure on us on a local area where the pilots fly a lot.
What kind of minimum qualifications do you have for a pilot? I'm guessing student pilots need not apply.
Yeah, we do have a minimum hour requirement of 750 hours as pilot in command, which is a little significantly higher than a lot of other volunteer organizations up. Like I said earlier, it's a little bit more intensive than just flying from point A to point B. So we're often low and slow maneuvering for views of specific points on the ground. So we require a little bit more flying experience. But other than that, just owner have access to a normal category, fixed wing or rotor aircraft. We don't conduct flights in light sport or ultralight experimental or home built aircraft. But valid pilot license, valid medical certificate, those are the basic requirements.
Do you interview prospective volunteer pilots as well? Or do you have to vet? When someone like Landon knocks on the South Wing's door and says, I want to fly for this organization, besides the things that you just mentioned, the qualifications and so forth, the hours, and are there other things that you look at?
Yeah, definitely. So knocking on our door would mean, submitting an inquiry form on our website. So we get that inquiry form. They've provided us their contact info. So I'll reach out and we'll just have, an initial phone call where we can explain South Wings and, our values and our commitment to safety and make sure that they understand that. And we'll get to know them. We'll let them ask any questions that they might have. And then after that phone call, if deemed appropriate, we will invite them to submit an application. And this collects information, more specific pilot information about their flying history. And after the application is in hand, we'll collect all those other pilot documents that we talked about. And then once everything is collected, we'll do an orientation call. And that's when they really get familiar with the flight request process and what it's going to, what to expect when they accept a flight and things like that. So there are several steps in the process and several points where we can, be on the lookout for red flags or anything like that to make sure that they're going to mesh with our commitment to safety and all of our other values.
Now, on the other side of it, in terms of requests that South Wings may get to conduct flights, how do you evaluate those? Do you refuse in some cases, or are they all valid requests?
Yeah, we definitely vet each flight request that comes through. We want to make sure that we're not wasting anybody's time. We're not just giving joyrides or anything here. We want to make sure that there's a clear objective and a clear purpose for the flight. We want to make sure that it's worthwhile for our pilots. If we're going to ask them to, use their resources to do this, we want to make sure that it's worthwhile for them to do. So our mission is to protect the natural world for future generations. So we'll consider any flight that aligns with that mission. And, we don't claim to know, all the solutions to all these environmental problems that are out there. Lots of people are working on lots of different, have lots of different ideas. And so we just want to work with people who are acting in good faith and who are trying to solve these problems. And, we always have our flight review committee. And if there are any questions or concerns about a flight that need to be discussed.
So that's interesting. Go ahead, David.
No, I was going to say, Landon, can you describe one of your favorite missions?
They're all interesting, but I've been flying like a professor from Emory for probably at least 5 or 6 years, and once or twice a year, doing a survey of the Georgia coast between the Savannah River and all the way down to the Florida border for things like erosion, tree die-off on the islands, some saltwater intrusion. It's a very interesting flight. Probably one of the most recently really interesting flight was a flight I took with a photographer named Henry Fair, and we were assessing, there's been a tremendous amount of loss of bird habitat along the coast of South Carolina, starting just south of Charleston and all the way up to Cape Romaine. It was not only interesting, but it was really important. And the outcomes of some of the work he did was really important for the Coastal Conservation League to promote some of its issues with coastal preservation. South Carolina has some of the largest salt marshes in the country. and they're very sensitive ecosystems, and they need a lot of protection and oversight. So, I mean, I would say that was really an interesting, very interesting flight.
This sounds to me like a great activity for a pilot to be involved in, because you're doing something, you know, potentially worthwhile. You're meeting new and interesting people. You know, you're getting to fly. Landon, is there a downside to this?
I don't know of any. I've enjoyed every single flight, and I mean, there's a few things we have. I haven't had a shall we say, an unruly passenger yet. Yeah. So, but that's largely because Chelsea and her colleagues they do a sort of a vetting process and let people know, and so everybody's highly interested in what they're doing and happy to be in your airplane and respectful.
Well, I see one obvious problem. I mean, I would imagine that pilots probably suffer from excessive grinning. I mean, is that something that?
Oh yeah, well it's hard on the maxillary. But it's really interesting stuff.
Go ahead, Rob.
I was going to say, do you think that one of the reasons you might have such docile passengers is when you tell them you're a Marine?
That's been known to have some effect on. And of course, if anybody gets unruly, you know, you could just put the airplane upside down and then talk them out of whatever their attitude is.
I'm sure that works.
I don't do that.
That's good. That is good.
Well, I think one of the other benefits we probably haven't mentioned is, I'm guessing, correct me if I'm wrong, it's probably tax deductible for the pilot as well, right?
It sure is, yeah. We collect your total number of volunteer hours that you have volunteered that year, and we'll provide you with that number at the end of the year to use for your tax purposes.
And I'm guessing the pilot pays for 100% of all the costs involved with the flight.
That's right. Yes, they do.
Yeah, and I don't think tax benefit is a central or primary motivation, but yes, it does defray some of the cost.
Yeah. So you mentioned Lighthawk and South, and also the sort of the region that South Wings covers. Is Lighthawk in a different region, or is that a national organization?
Yeah, Lighthawk essentially at this point, I believe, is national. They basically fly everywhere that South Wings doesn't. So they started out west, and they have also done some flights in Mexico and Canada as well. I know they've done some flights even up in Alaska. And outside of South Wing service area, that's Lighthawk territory. And they're our sister organization. We have a really great harmonious relationship with Lighthawk. We have collaborated on flights, sharing pilots. A lot of our pilots are actually Lighthawk pilots as well, volunteer for both organizations. So,
and what is it that South Wings needs? Do you need more pilots? Do you need more funds? Or what do you need more of that you don't have now?
I'll jump in on that, because you know, obviously we do fundraising, because we are an organization that needs to raise funds from the public, and we always need pilots. Those are the two obvious ones. But one of the other things that we really can use is for people to talk about our mission. Everywhere you go, I'm sure there's some environmental issue that can benefit from a South Wings flight, and people sometimes think that we're going to charge them or whatever, because I've gotten that when I've talked about being in with a conservation group and say, you know, you guys could really use some South Wings flights. It would help you with your cause. And there's sort of hesitation about, well, what's it going to cost? And then when you tell them absolutely nothing, you know, 2 hours of your time, oh, then the AA batteries got changed and they get interested. So telling people about us and what we can do is would be very helpful. And I'll let Chelsea talk about anything else she wants to mention. But
yeah, no, absolutely.
I was just going to say, Chelsea, could you perhaps tell us about the story that ran in the South Wings, I guess it was the magazine, in December of last year about this longest running oil spill in U.S. history and how you guys kind of fit into all that?
Yeah, definitely. This is one of the longest, longest running issues that we've been a part of. So in the summer of 2010, we began flying to help document the scope and the scale of the BP Deepwater Horizon disaster in the Gulf of Mexico. And around this time, one of our partners, SkyTruth, they were using satellite imagery, and they noticed another nearby slick, which was completely separate from the BP spill. And so Southwing's pilots began flying with our partners to document that oil spill as well, which we now know is the Taylor Energy oil spill. It was being reported that the size of the leak was much smaller than it actually was. So our partners were just trying to bring awareness to it and prove that the leak was larger than reported and push for something to be done about it, because nothing really was being done about it. And no one really even knew about it. So then that was 2010. In 2018, after 23 other Southwing's flights to document the spill, an investigative journalist, Daryl Fears, he took a flight with Southwing's, and his story with photos from the flight ended up on the front page of the Washington Post. And the very next day, the Coast Guard finally ordered Taylor Energy to clean up their mess and install a containment structure. Now, unfortunately, and as to be expected, Taylor Energy decided to fight this in the courts for years. But finally, in 2021, they agreed to drop all remaining lawsuits and actually plug the well, which is ideal. It ended up being the longest running, and actually I don't think that work is complete, so I think it's still even leaking to this day. And so it's the longest running oil spill in U.S. history. We're thankful to have been a very small part in getting that win for the Gulf Coast.
Wow, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, that is really nice. It's got to make you feel really good when you think about some of these accomplishments. You know, I mean, sometimes you could minimize the role, but, you know, you take that role that what Southwing's did out of that, you know, out of that example, and it would have been completely different. So in some ways, maybe it's small, but in other ways, it's really big, I think, really big.
Yeah, yeah. It is an important distinction that, you know, Southwing, we're not the ones who have the successes, our flight partners do, and we're just one of those tools that helps them achieve those big wins. But we are very grateful to be able to help with that.
Yeah, I just tell folks I'm a bus driver. That it's the people in the back seat that do the work. So
right, yeah, you're focused on the flying, and they're focused on what they want to do.
So it sounds like part of what you're looking to do is to grow the number of environmental people, reporters, groups that come to you and ask for help. Is that kind of one of the ways you're looking to grow the organization? And if so, what's the growth been like over the years in terms of number of flights per year or number of organizations you're involved with?
Yeah, that's definitely one of the goals. It kind of has to grow at the same time, which is the number of flight requests we get and then also the number of pilots. We kind of have to have enough pilots to fulfill the flight requests, and we want enough flight requests so that our pilots have something to do. But yeah, so let's see, 2019 was our highest flight total, which was 170. And I believe that year we worked with over 100 different organizations. And the following year, 2020, we had 55 flights because of the pandemic. Everything really slowed down. No one really wanted to get in a very confined space for an extended period of time. So definitely saw a very low number of flights in 2020, and we're slowly starting to creep back up towards that 2019 number. Last year, we had 127 flights. And about, you know, 30 to 40 flights per year will end up getting canceled, either due to weather or, you know, pilot unavailability due to, you know, a plane issue or something like that.
And do you have requirements in terms of how good the weather has to be or things like that, personal minimums for pilots?
Most of the flying is going to be VFR because interestingly, especially with people that are trying to get good photographs of a particular situation on the ground, they want to have fairly decent light. So there is some coordination about not just flying type weather, but photograph weather. So that, you've got to sort of learn to, you want to get the sun on one side so the picture is right and stuff like that. So most of the flying is going to be VFR because by the nature, you're looking at stuff. You're flying in a situation to observe what's on the ground. And again, I know most of the pilots that I know have plenty margin of safety. I mean, they're not going to push the envelope on ceilings or visibility or whatever.
Landon, any modifications to the aircraft to sort of facilitate photography or, you know, or whatever, or not necessary?
Well, this is something that we're actually, as an organization, we're addressing now and really thinking about, because, you know, the GoPro on the outside of the airplane and a few other things, we're reviewing how to do that safely and to be avoid problems, because there can be problems, especially if things start falling off and banging around if they're attached by a wire or something like that. So you can get certain attachments certified and approved and so forth. But the issue of what goes on outside the airplane is something we're taking a hard look at and may derive some policies about. In the case of the Bird Dog that I fly, it's designed to have two big rear windows that are open and snap up. So I just tell people, don't put your cell phone outside the airplane. And people have, and those cell phones are at the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean. I don't know, Chelsea, do you want to say anything about the issues with what goes on outside, on the outside of the airplane and stuff?
Yeah, our general, you know, stance on that is we are not going to tell you how to do that, or that you should do that, or that you're not allowed to do that. You know, you need to know what the FAR say about that. You need to know what your insurance policy says about that. So as far as, you know, attaching any sort of camera or anything to the outside of a plane, it's definitely, you know, case by case basis. And the pilot really needs to know if it's allowed. You know, we're not the Southwings is not the operator flight. We always refer to our pilots, defer to our pilots, depend on our pilots to know how to comply with the FAA.
So other than cell phones flying out the window and going to the bottom of the Atlantic, have there been other kind of unusual or interesting situations that have occurred? Anything funny, memorable, or tragic?
Well, I had one flight. I was flying a river keeper on a upper river where there was a pollutant, a large paper mill type thing. And I was, let's say they launched another aircraft to try to interfere with our flight.
That's where the rockets come in, Landon?
That's right. No, my 337, they're deactivated, so... I don't think there have been. We've had a few of those cell phone surprises. No matter how much you tell people, we tell people not to, you know, to take off any big lens covers if they're going to stick them outside of the airplane and things like that. But most of the time, Chelsea, have you had any weird situations?
No, certainly nothing tragic. Never had any accidents on any Southwings flights. We have experienced some. Particularly when we were flying a lot, covering, you know, mountaintop removal coal mining in Appalachia, it's a hotbed topic. A lot of people's livelihoods depend on it. And there was an airport owner who really did not like that we were using his airport to conduct these flights. Tried to not, you know, get us banned from the airport, or luckily he wasn't allowed to do that. But generally the worst thing that we'll ever experience are some side eyes or something like that, if someone doesn't fully agree with what we're doing. But nothing really too exciting or out of the ordinary happens on these flights.
What airspeed are you flying at?
Depending on the situation, we may go into a little bit of slow flight or certainly there's sort of, at least with the Bird Dog, there's sort of a way to do a skid so that you can kind of fly in a straight line and let the photographer have a long view of what you're trying to film. Your airspeeds are down to under 80 knots or 70, 65, something like that. I rarely put the flaps down for slow flight, because the flaps would intrude in the picture. But occasionally some photographs will, you'll see maybe that rear end of the rocket tube or something. But other than that, pretty much certainly under 90 knots, 80 knots, 75 knots, and a little bit slower sometimes, and often in a skid for the purpose of photography.
And that does vary as well, depending on what type of aircraft our pilots have. We have all sorts of aircraft on the roster. Some are, you know, more high performance aircraft and don't go that slow. And lots of these flights can be done with any sort of aircraft, really.
Chelsea, you're not a pilot yourself, correct?
That's right. I do not have a background in aviation.
So as a result of you working with Southwings, you must have picked up a lot of knowledge about flying. And haven't Landon and the others convinced you to start taking flying lessons yet?
They certainly try. I hear it from a lot of my pilots that I should take it up, but I don't know if I have the skills for that.
No, you probably have too much good sense. That's all I can figure.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, this has been fascinating. You mentioned that both of you, that one of the things that you could use is more awareness in certain quarters. And I think we can help with that a little bit. And maybe you'll be hearing from some of our listeners or be able to make some contacts through your appearance here. But meantime, where can people learn more about Southwings? Chelsea, probably the website?
Yeah, that would be a great first place to go, southwings.org. It's got all lots and lots of info about being a pilot, about, you know, what our flights accomplish, our flight partners. We also are on all the social medias, so check us out on any platform. But yeah, if a pilot is listening and they're interested in doing some volunteer flying, go ahead and fill out that inquiry form and someone will reach out, and probably me, well, definitely me, I'll be the one reaching out to get the conversation started.
Excellent, excellent. Well, we want to thank you both, Chelsea and Landon, for coming on the show. It's been, I love it when we talk to people that are involved in something that has a great deal of value and a certain amount of pleasure and a certain amount of benefit, both to, you know, to you and to others. And I mean, it sounds like that's exactly what you guys are up to with Southwing. So we want to thank you for coming on the show.
It's been great.
Yeah. Thank you so much for giving us a moment with your audience.
Our pleasure.
I just have one last question for Landon. I mean,
I knew it. I knew it. I knew it.
Well, I just want to know the answer to this. This is it's been gnawing at me all evening.
Go ahead, Columbo.
Have you looked into the cost of perhaps equipping your aircraft with those rocket launchers, just in case you needed them?
You mean for other aircraft? Because mine, but there's a little thing called a 337 form, which means, and part of the certification to put them on, because the Bird Dog has hard points for armament, so that's already there. Most airplane wings don't have them. But if you're going to put those little jobbies on your plane, you have to prove to the FAA that the wires are all connected to that it can be live. So there's an inspection process, although, you know, people see them and get all excited. But basically, they have to be inert.
Sure. You could have an answer prepared. I mean, when they look and they say, are those live? And you go, oh. You mean those? Oh, yeah. I didn't even notice those. And then you just kind of go on, and they'll buy that, I bet.
Those are for fishing.
Yeah, I remember one. That's right. I remember one time a little kid came up. I was at an air show and part of the static display, and a little kid came up and said, "Oh, does this have a machine gun?" And I said, "No, but it has rockets." And I pointed, and he said, "Rockets? Oh, I mean, I thought I just, you know, kind of, I don't know." They made it, and he wanted to get in the cockpit, so I sat him up in the cockpit and you let him, you know, push buttons and things.
I think, Landon, I think you sending out Willie Pete to your targets for your other photography aircraft would be a good idea.
Well, that's what they're for.
I think you need to go back to old school Vietnam. Let's go target this. Here's your mark. Go get
mark the targets, and then some of Chelsea's high performance airplanes can do a big gun run. You know,
exactly.
Yeah, I'm trying to grow up. Ron,
that's
know,
no fun.
I'm trying to become an adult. We can't do these things.
Can't do that and be a pilot. So you got to choose.
That's right. But anyway, it's fun flying the airplane.
We are going to take a brief break from the episode because I've become aware of a project that our friend Brian Coleman is involved in. And this is something very interesting. It's a very worthy cause and something that we think all of you should be aware of as soon as possible, because Brian's looking for some help. This is about the Flight Team Internship Program out of the California Science Center. And Brian and I had just a brief little conversation about it, and we're going to slip it in here. And here is my conversation with Brian. I'm here with our friend Brian Coleman. Brian, it's nice to be speaking with you again, and especially on an interesting topic here. And I understand that there's a project that's being undertaken by the California Science Center, and that you have some involvement in this project.
I do. I've been asked to help out in their summer intern program, and it's called Flight Team. And what the Science Center is doing, they're going to some underprivileged high schools in Los Angeles, and they have this intern program for 11th and 12th graders, so juniors and seniors, that are interested in aviation. And this is a summer intern program to get them involved and really sort of spearhead, champion their enthusiasm towards aviation and show them really what the industry is all about.
Wow, what a great thing to do. Is this something that's brand new for them?
It is. This is the first year that they're doing it. They're hoping that it will be a success and they'll continue on in future years. So part of the problem, and really the reason why I'm on the show tonight, is we have a lot of development to do. Mm-hmm. Right? And building out courseware and curriculum, there's just a lot of stuff that needs to happen.
Well, what are some examples of the program and the kinds of activities that these students would be involved in?
It's an immersive program where they learn about aviation, really from the physics of flight through careers in aviation and really every aspect. And as we've covered on the show, there's really a never-ending list of topics that you can talk about in regards to aviation. And of course, most people think about being a pilot and that's it. But as we know, there's so much more than that that goes on that makes up the industry of aviation.
Of course. And so the intent here is to expose these students to all of these different kinds of opportunities for possible careers in the aviation field.
Exactly. So it's not only commercial flight, which I think most people think of, but there's the engineering aspect, the air traffic control, the flight operations. There's so many different parts. And the idea in this 8-week program is to introduce the kids to each of these segments and hopefully continue to foster their interest in it and help them along the way.
This is a great thing. I think there's nothing more meaningful, perhaps, that we can do than help younger people get the exposure, develop the interest in them, or allow them to develop their own interests in this area. Bringing the youngsters in is always a good thing in filling the pipeline, but also bringing a variety of different types of students in to the field. Just kind of strengthens the field, I think.
Yeah, and for me, that's really what piqued my interest in this, is the Science Center is in a disadvantaged neighborhood. They're focusing on high schools that have disadvantaged students. And in particular, again, what really drew me into this was they really wanted to focus on young girls. So yes, the program's opened up to boys as well, but they really want to skew it to a 60-40 or 80-20 membership in this intern program. So they really want to help these kids. And again, as we've said so many times on the show, if you don't see someone doing the job, you just don't see it as a possibility of you doing it. And that's why I'm really excited to help them out and bring in different resources and aspects to this program.
And so this is a program that's starting this summer, which is fast approaching. What is it that is needed to get this started in a successful way?
Yeah, so this is an 8-week program, and it starts in late June. And the first part of it is really going to be the science of flight or the physics of flight. The second part of the program is going to be really an introduction to careers and all the different things that kids can go and gain employment in the industry. So what we need is basically everything. So my ask for the Airplane Geeks audience is, especially if you're located in Southern California, but that's not a limiting factor. But if you're in Southern California and you work for a commercial airline, you work at an airport, you work in an engineering firm that supports aviation, if there's anything that you could do, if you think that you could donate an hour of time and lecture for these kids, you know, give a presentation over what your job is. If you are a software developer and have flight sim software, if you're an expert in flight sim software and can talk about that, if you are in education and can provide any materials over courseware or talk about the future of education, you know, where they could go, different degree programs, you know, if you're a private pilot and would be willing to have some students, and we're talking 8 students here or 8 interns, come and view your airplane and go through how you create a flight plan, why a weather report's important, why you do weight and balance. Just show the kids the different aspects of what's inside the hangar, right? The different parts of the airplane, and just let them see and possibly touch. So it's really anybody that has anything that they think they can offer, I would love to talk with them and fit them into the schedule.
This is great. And this is a voluntary kind of effort, correct? On the part of the people that might be contributing something to the program.
Correct. Yeah. For example, my bit is 100% voluntary. However, because the California Science Center is a nonprofit agency, if somebody contributes something, we have the ability to write the in-kind donation letter. So the value of whatever you contribute can be deducted. And it could be even something if you work for a company that has some t-shirts or some lanyards or notebooks or whatever that's logoed with your company name on it. We're quite happy to accept that and put that into the gift bag for these students. And again, you would get the tax deduction paperwork for that contribution that you've made.
Well, Brian, how can people contact you if they have something that they might be able to offer?
Oh, the best way to get a hold of me is send an email to brian@airplanegeeks.com.
Well, that's pretty easy.
It is. The same email address I've had for years.
That's right. And this is requires kind of a timely response, because as we mentioned, the program is starting soon. So people who can contribute something should do that right away, or contact you right away, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, we're really looking for everything. And I would say, if you're on the fence over, well, should I contribute? Would this really make sense? Please get a hold of me, and it'll be really easy for me to say either yes or no. I would much rather have way too many people volunteer stuff than people be hesitant, but we could actually use it. And again, I'm really looking for things in every aspect of aviation. If it's commercial, private, cargo operations, again, you know, if you're a flight planner, if you're a dispatcher, anything at all that you could possibly contribute, I think would be a nice addition to this program.
Well, Brian Coleman, you're a good man, And this is a really worthy project. I'm happy that you're part of it because you can make things happen. And yeah. I think the students may not see all that goes on behind the scenes to get it set up, but I think they're going to really appreciate the result when it all is said and done. So thank you, Brian.
And thank you, and thank you to everyone who considers contributing to this program. We really appreciate it, and I'm sure the kids will too.
Yes. All right. You heard it. What a great idea this is. And we'll return now to the program in progress. What's up with the geeks? Oh, Max Truscott, what's new with you?
Oh, busy, busy week here. I've going to be putting out a show on Aviation News Talk this week about something that's really important to pilots who are interested in a career in aviation. And that is for folks that are headed to the airlines, are always trying to figure out how to acquire 1,500 hours of piloting experience, since that's the minimum required to get an ATP, and you need to get an ATP to become an airline pilot. And there are probably a dozen different ways that people can get paid to do various jobs to help build that time. So I found an expert who's going to come on the show who's had some experience in a number of those jobs. So that's what we're doing this week.
You're going to have an expert come on the show?
Yeah.
So I know it's not me because you didn't ask me. It wouldn't be Rob, would it?
No, I said I was going to have an expert on the show.
Okay, that session, Max, canceled. Gone.
Yes, of course it's Rob. Who else? Who else would we have to come on and talk about that? That guy has had so many different jobs in aviation. He's the perfect guy for this discussion. So, yes, join us this week on Aviation News Talk to hear Rob and I talk about how to get your 1,500 hours.
And which episode number is that going to be?
Do you know? Gosh, that'll be 323.
Okay, good. 323. David, anything to report from the museum?
All things quiet. I'm still prepping. We got 1 month to go before we have rockets and rotors, and Snoopy enters the space program, which we have been working on. I've been working on the exhibit. The Snoopy program is actually a exhibit done by the Charles Schulz Museum out in California, and we'll have various artifacts from NASA, as well as the history of Apollo 10. Of course, the command module was Charlie Brown. The lunar module was Snoopy. And then, of course, rockets and rotors, where we're going to talk about old 66. If you ever seen a picture of an Apollo capsule with a Sea King helicopter above it, it probably was 66. It's probably one of the most famous helicopters ever, as well as a lot of the NASA rotorcraft that have been developed over the years that have NASA used. So a little bit of everything, and that's coming the last weekend in May.
All right, excellent. All right, we have a little bit of listener mail. Well, recently we were talking about sort of the relationship between the FAA and, well, any airframer or aerospace company, in this case Boeing, in terms of oversight and audits and approving quality systems and, you know, all of that kind of thing. So on that topic, Mark wrote into us, and he said, "I really enjoy listening to your podcast. Great each week. Now, as a fully qualified accountant," he writes, "and a former auditor with an MBA, the FAA's certification process with Boeing is very similar to audit partners issuing audit reports for major American companies. They rely on controls previously established and regularly tested and management's signed off assurances." And he says, "Perhaps you could get the auditor of major manufacturing companies in, and without disclosing client specifics, talk about the parallel approach that would or should be occurring at Boeing with the FAA." He says, "Thanks for the great podcasts, past and future." And that's from Mark. He's in Perth, Western Australia. It's kind of an interesting idea because, yeah, this sort of regulator oversight of different industries, you know, I mean, this happens very frequently. And, you know, we've wondered about the relationship between the FAA and Boeing, and that maybe we can learn you know, more about how those things are successful and where they're not by taking a look at, you know, a different industry or someone who's involved in those kinds of oversight audits. So interesting suggestion. So we'll kind of keep that in mind, keep our eye open for someone that might be able to work with us on that. And then Rich wrote in, he says, I'm listening to your podcast right now, and I'm listening closely to see if you say the B word. Not bad so far. Yeah, that was last week. I think I counted one. And for the benefit of Landon and Chelsea, our recent episodes have been so filled with Boeing news and issues and this, all of that, that we were all kind of growing a little bit weary of it. So that's where the B word comes in. He wanted to comment on mentioning Mach numbers when we were talking about Mach numbers and hypersonics and supersonics. I think, David, you mentioned something about saying, you know, Mach numbers go up exponentially. And maybe you were talking about the difficulty in, you know, overcoming them. But Rich writes in, says exponentially isn't exactly correct. He said Mach 2 is 2 times the speed of sound and Mach 3 is 3 times the speed of sound. He said if it were exponential, Mach 2 would be 10 times Mach 1 and Mach 3 would be 100 times Mach 1. Technically correct. He says, I'm an electrical engineer, not an aeronautical engineer, but I found a site helpful for the calculations of Mach numbers. And this is from something at sciencetrends.com. It's titled Mach Speed, from Mach 1 to Mach 3 Speed and Beyond. And it's kind of an interesting and fairly detailed look at Mach numbers. And Rich notes that according to this website, Mach numbers are essentially a ratio of the object's speed to the speed of sound. The speed of sound will change with temperature and altitude, so it isn't fixed. At higher altitudes, the speed of sound is lower, which, of course, is true. And it points out that Mach 1, Mach 2, Mach 3, those are not actually specific speeds. They are multiples of whatever the speed of sound is in the environment in which that aircraft is currently flying. So we'll have a link to this article from Science Trends in the show notes. It really is pretty interesting. And then I see a photograph in the show plan here. Landon, is this your airplane that I see? Or David, did you put this in? Is this a...
Yes, I did. That's Landon's airplane.
Is that Landon's airplane? You actually found it.
He's made a very easy N number to find.
Yeah. Where'd you pull the picture from?
This is aircraft.com.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it shows your plane chained down on the runway, or not on the runway, but on the apron there, with another interesting looking aircraft behind it.
Oh, that must have been on the Marine Corps Air Station Beaufort. It was some sort of a weird experimental or white, you know, white in color behind
yes,
it.
Yes, yeah, with a.
It's a white Yak 50, two-seat Yak 52.
Yeah, that was at Marine Corps Air Station Beaufort during a Blue Angel show.
The other picture's got the better pictures of the rockets.
Oh, I didn't even see the other picture. Okay. Oh, I see. We're going to put these in the show notes for sure.
Oh, dear.
Sure looks like Sav's rockets to me.
So that's cool. So those are dummy rockets. Are they?
They're actual 2.75 Zuni rockets, white phosphorus warheads. But the motors are without their explosives and their propellant. So.
So you didn't have to dummy up. Did a plane come with those?
It didn't when I bought it, but I know, there's sort of a network of Looney Tunes, like those of us that fly these things. And, I could find a set of rocket tubes and the whole system that went on it. It did have the arming panel above the pilot's head. So it was already, cause there's a couple of safety switches that prevent them from.
What size is the engine on that bird dog? Is that a 140 or a 150? Or
it's an 0470 11. It's rated about 240 horse, 235 horse.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I mean the bird dog was built to be able to climb out, get in. It's has a climb prop on it, so it's not designed to go real fast, but it's designed to be able to, you know, change altitudes quickly and get in and out of small expeditionary strips. It's one of the reasons why the landing gear is a little bit springy, and if you're not used to flying it, you can do a lot of bouncing. But it was designed to take a lot of punishment when you went into roads and things like that.
So was this used, were the missions primarily observation or?
The ones I flew?
Yes.
They ran the gamut. They were, we mostly went out looking for trouble and either calling in artillery or if we found an enemy, we'd mark them with rockets and then call in the fast movers fly convoy cover, do all kinds of stuff. There was a tremendous amount of, we got shot at a lot.
Yeah, yeah. And you had already done some flying before you entered the military, I take it.
Yeah, I had a private pilot's license, but I wasn't in the aviation pipeline. So my primary MOS as a Marine was artillery and then infantry because I was a platoon leader on the ground for half of my first tour in Vietnam. But I'd been to a school for aerial observation, so I came back out of the bush and then started flying.
Wow. Amazing. Amazing. Yeah, we're definitely going to, we've talked about this airplane, you know, on and off throughout this this episode for you listening. So take a look at the website at airplanegeeks.com and you can.
That's because the history nerd likes bird dogs.
You do like bird dogs.
I really like bird dogs.
They're an awesome airplane.
Yeah, yeah. All right, good. All right, so I think we're going to wrap it up. Chelsea, anything you need to you'd like to add?
Landon said the word Blue Angels, so I just was like, hey, I have something to say. I went to a air show yesterday, then the Blue Angels were there, and it was very, very, very – it was my first time seeing the Blue Angels, and I think it was – actually, I'm technically my first air show, really. It was incredible. We saw also the F-16 Viper, yeah, which was, oh my gosh, so cool, so loud. It was incredible. It just all took your breath away. It was very, very cool.
Which show did you go to?
It's at the Maxwell Air Force Base here. I'm in Montgomery, Alabama. So it was the Beyond the Horizon air show.
Yeah, yeah. And it was your first air show, you said?
Yeah.
Pretty
yeah,
cool,
technically.
Huh?
I mean, yeah, I've been to very small ones, but this is the, I mean, yeah, this is the first time I've been to one like this. It was very cool.
Yeah. There you go, Landon. She's kind of getting the bug a little bit.
Oh yeah, the blues will do it to you. And yeah, yeah. And one of the pilots was a female, correct? She was a woman flying.
Yes.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. She's a Marine.
So we got to get Chelsea out to Oshkosh then.
Yes.
Chelsea, if we'll protect you. Don't worry. This is a gang of thieves here.
Yeah, I know.
They're trying to get you in the airplane.
We're plotting.
Oshkosh sounds
she'll never
like
come
just,
back.
So does South Wings, the organization, ever, you know, have a presence at air shows or events?
Yeah, actually, yeah. We've never been to Oshkosh, but we have had tables at Sun and Fun and a smaller air show in South Carolina, and then a couple other like AOPA events and things like that.
All right. Well, you know how to reach us. So, if you need us to help get the word out, just be sure to call on us.
All right. That's great. Thank you.
That's super.
All right. So we'll wrap it up. Again, thanks for listening to the Airplane Geeks podcast. We really want to thank our guest, Chelsea Easter. Again, she's the Director of Operations and Volunteer Pilot Engagement at South Wings, and Landon Thorne. He's not only a volunteer pilot, but also a board member. And thank both of you again for coming on the show.
It was great. Great experience.
Thanks for having us.
Find us at airplanegeeks.com. The direct link to the show notes for this episode is airplanegeeks.com/794, because that's the episode number. And, of course, our email address is thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. All right. Max Trescott, anything closing?
Sure, you can find me at the usual places, either out on the tarmac teaching at the Palo Alto Airport, or head on out to aviationnewstalk.com and click on contact at the top of the page.
Terrific. And Rob Mark, where do you find you?
Well, until tonight, I was going to be joining Max on the his new show tomorrow, but I don't know. I'm thinking...
Reconsidering, huh?
Flying around in a bird dog with rockets. It seems way cooler. So, Max, you know, maybe you can still talk me into it. No, you can find us in between the pages of numerous aviation magazines, what few there are left, and also at jetwine.com.
All right. And David Vanderhoof, how about you?
You can find me at the American Helicopter Museum. I welcome everybody to come in, and you can fly in. You don't have to. I mean, we're at an airport. Landon, if you ever want to take your bird dog up to Pennsylvania, let me know.
Okay.
Or you can, of course, find me on Twitter, Facebook, etc. if you can spell Vanderhoof.
All right. And I'm Max Flight. Mostly you can find me here, but there are a couple other places that I hang out. You can find those over at 30,000feet.com. Okay, so please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Keep the blue side up.
Nighty-night.
Thanks for listening.